Today on Family Talk.
Well, hello, everyone. You're listening to Family Talk. I'm your host, Dr. James Dobson, and we have a very interesting program for you today. It's going to begin with some comments about effective storytelling, which involves an understanding of human emotion and things that are of interest to men and women. Effective storytelling is also about the method of imparting truth and values to the hearer. We all know that Jesus spoke in parables, which are stories. And it bothers me often that I sit in church services and I hear ministers, pastors, other speakers who prattle on about things and ideas and even scriptural principles and don't get around to telling stories that would capture the hearts and minds of the people. And I look around, I see people yawning. I mean, people do not understand the importance of spoken word, but especially as related to stories. And we have a guest today who is a wonderful storyteller. He's Darrell Campbell. He's a professional screenwriter, an author, a director, an actor, and a producer with over 37 years of experience in communication. And he's here today to share some of his stories. Yeah, stories about a man that we both knew and admired. I had a brief encounter with him. This man knows him far better. And we're talking about Pistol Pete Maravich, who's gone on to be with the Lord. And some of you are aware that I met him on a basketball court, which is strange because he's one of the greatest players of all times. And I had the audacity to ask him if he'd like to play with us. And he said that he would, a little pickup basketball game. And he came for the first time that I had met him, and we got out on the court. We had a wonderful time. We played for about 45 minutes, and then everybody went to get a drink, and Pete and I stayed on the court, and we were talking to each other. And he was talking about having a problem with his right shoulder and how he hadn't been able to play basketball in some time. And with that, I walked away from him. He had just said how great he felt. And I turned around and looked at him, and he fell. And he went face down into the floor. And I'm not going to elaborate because I've told the story many times, but we tried to resuscitate him. Some of the other guys came and pumped his heart, and I tried CPR. We called for the ambulance, and they came a little too late. It took about 10 minutes to get there. And he was gone, one of the greatest shocks of my life. And I had great love and respect for this man, even though I didn't know him very well, because he sincerely loved and believed in Jesus Christ. He was wearing a T-shirt on that day that said, "Looking unto Jesus." Everything he said and did after he found Jesus, which was late in life, and we're going to talk about that today. But at 40 years of age, he just left us. And I want to talk to Darrell about this. Darrell, I want you to tell us some stories about Pete Maravich today. You have written a book called Hero and Friend, My Days with Pistol Pete Maravich. You did become his friend, didn't you?
I did. It was one of the greatest privileges in my life. And I just want to start this little conversation with you to say that you've been one of my heroes, and I'm glad that you're my friend.
My goodness. You're going to write a book about heroes and friends.
Be careful. I'm taking notes over here right now.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Well, you have had an incredible career. We could take the whole program to talk about the television work you've done with Carol Burnett and Tim Allen and others. And you moved from one thing to another, but now you are promoting this book, and I appreciate your coming by. You care a lot about the content of this book, don't you?
I do. It starts with my father, I think, to be honest. As you get into the book, I begin to lace together how much Pete, his father, my father, and I seem to have so much in common, and yet we were from such different worlds at different times even.
Well, he was coming to Pasadena, California, where I lived, to be on my radio program that day, and he died before we had a chance to do that. I regret not having his final comments, but he was going to talk about his father and about the book that you helped him write. In fact, you ghostwrote it or co-wrote it with Pete, called Heir to a Dream, about his father.
The journey begins with a guy calling me. I was writing Days of Our Lives at the time, and I got a phone call from a friend on the East Coast. He said, "Hey, would you like to write a movie about Pistol Pete Maravich?" And I said, "Of course, I'd love to do a movie about Pistol Pete Maravich." He said, "Well, I want you to meet him." And I said, "I'd love to meet him." So I went out to, I want to say it was Fountain Valley, where he was practicing basketball with Meadowlark Lemon's Shooting Stars. It was a group.
This is after he'd left the NBA.
That's correct. Yeah, a few years later. It had been about 6 years later, actually. Pete had walked away from the game in 1980. And all these years later, somebody had coaxed him into playing with the Meadowlark. And the reason being, Pete didn't care about the basketball. He wanted to share his faith. And that was going to give him a platform. And so I went out to this gym, and I walk in there, and I remember sitting on a table, actually, it was at the end of the room, and they're playing, I'm just watching Pete, I'm like, I'm in the presence of this guy that as a...
Oh, I felt the same way. Oh. He made moves on that morning I've never seen anybody make.
Unbelievable.
And this is just a pickup basketball game.
Yes, sir. I'm sitting there at the end of the court watching the legend. I'm going, this is, I know he's retired. I know the whole thing, but it didn't matter to me. He was making every shot he seemed to put up there, and he was talking to the guys and laughing. And so he walks over to me. He goes, "How's it going?" I said, "Hi, Pete." He goes, "You go to school here?" And I looked at him and said, "Oh, no." I know I looked like I was about 19 years old. And I said, "No, sir, I'm going to write the book about your life. I'm going to write the movie about your life at the time." He goes, "I thought you were just a kid. I thought you'd be a student here. And you look like you could still be in college." I said, "Well, you look like you could still play." He says, "Well, looks are deceiving."
You know what? It occurs to me that we're talking about a man that some people in our listening audience have never heard of and don't know about. He was one of the greatest basketball players of all time. Talk about his early life and how his father was a coach, and give us that story and take it through LSU, where he played basketball.
I'll try to do it justice. One of the reasons I wanted to pull the letters, the notes I'd gotten from him, things that he had written on a napkin. I mean, I have those in my files at home. I want to put it in a book because this year, Doc, is the 50th anniversary of Pistol Pete Maravich breaking and setting the NCAA scoring record. So for 50 years.
It still stands.
Still stands.
And those were the days when they didn't have a three-point line. Therefore, he had to make all those shots.
Yes, sir. And another thing, he only played 83 games. So they didn't count his freshman year. He had over 700 points there. No three-point line. And 3 years of eligibility means that you have to average 44.2 points per game to get to 3,667 points. Okay? That record has stood for 50 years. This next basketball season will be the 50th anniversary of his breaking the record.
He went on into the NBA after that. He was the first million-dollar baby. No one had ever received that kind of bonus. And he was a sensation then. And loved basketball. He did things with a basketball no one has ever done. I often say that he was magic before magic was magic.
Yeah, magic. Well,
I've seen the videos of things, his films of things that he had done. But Pete was not a very nice man in those days.
You ask about his childhood. Let me start there. He was that kid who loved his father, and his father had been a professional basketball player back when they rode around in an old black car with five guys in it. They got $5 a night. Mm-hmm. It was like with the Iron Men and the Detroit Eagles. He had some great stories for me. So that's what really got me intrigued about the father and son connection. So when Pete was born, Press, his dad, said to the doctor, "This baby will be the greatest basketball player who ever lived."
Did he really?
Yes.
And he set out to make him that.
That's correct. So he was the coach from the crib. Press, who, remember, was a professional basketball player, would go out in the driveway and shoot baskets as Pete is this little boy looking out the window watching his daddy. But he wouldn't let him come. He said, no, you stay inside. I'll be shooting out here. Stay with your mother. It was like he was baiting him. And one night, Helen, his mother, convinced press to let Pete join his dad out there in the driveway. And that's what began the legend.
That mother later committed suicide, didn't she?
Yes, unfortunately.
Is that generally known, or is that a family secret?
It's known now. It's been in print for a while. You know, it's been in other books.
What impact did that have on the man he became?
It was a huge impact. The day I met him, we had lunch, and he was eating some sort of really healthy fish and salad, and I had a burger and fries, and he would look at me and go, you know, that stuff will kill you, right? And so we're eating, and along he goes, yeah, do you think my mother is in hell? I said, well, excuse me? He said, well, you know, I keep picturing this blackness of hell, and I'm afraid, and he kind of got choked up. Uh-huh. And this is the first time I've met him, but he felt open enough to share that with me, because what he had gone through, and this is very, very, very personal, but, you know, his mother was an alcoholic. It was very difficult on press. His dad, you know, he was trying to recruit for LSU and these other teams that he worked for, but he couldn't really go out away from the house because he was afraid to leave his wife alone. So I think in many ways, Pete was really happy to get away from that, you know, when he entered the pros. And I have talked to other players and people who knew him through college, and, you know, they would talk about this kind of sad character, this guy that oftentimes felt like he was doing battle alone. You know, but, you know, I didn't know that guy. I knew the one who had been saved.
Well, let me share with you the other half of what I think I know about him.
Okay.
Is that he was really kind of lost even when he was in the NBA. He had all this money, all of this acclaim and everything, but he was looking for something, and that something, somebody, was Jesus. And nobody introduced him to Jesus, at least not so that he accepted it. And then finally his knees gave out, and he was in a house, and he couldn't go anywhere much because people hounded him, you know, wanting autographs and pictures and everything. So he was there in that house for, I think, a couple of years, and he was really lost during that time. His career was over, and where did he go from here? Well, and then tell us about the morning that he heard Jesus' name.
Okay. Well, he had lost everything in his mind. He had lost everything that he was. You know, he'd tell you, I had admiral status in the Navy, you know, honorary status, obviously. He said, I had money in my pocket. I had the Porsche. I had the home, the pretty wife. I had everything. He said, but I was so empty. I was looking for a happiness in money and in everything else. But I was just empty. So one night he's driving across the bridge over Lake Pontchartrain. And he said, man, you know, he was in his little Porsche 911, which I got to sit in, which was wonderful. But he was flying across that bridge, and he said, man, if I just turn the wheel just a little bit, I'll just wipe out this car and myself, and it'll be over for me. I won't have to worry about anything else. He was so empty and so sad. Well, he didn't do that. The grace of God, he did not do that. He made it home that night, crawled into bed. Jackie's laying there, breaking out in a sweat. He said, it's just wet. He goes, Lord, you got to save me. If you are real, then come into my life now and be real to me. And he would say this over and over. He heard an audible voice that said, lift thine own heart. And I said, say that again, Pete. He said, lift thine own heart. So I thought somebody was in the room. And he shakes his wife, says, wake up, did you hear that? And she thought he was just like, this guy was into ufology, he was into Eastern religions, he was into all kinds of things filling his head. She just thought this was another kooky moment. And he said, Jack, did you hear that? She goes, no. And he goes, God spoke to me. And that's the night his life was changed forever.
He told me he sat up in bed and heard it again. Mm. Twice the Lord spoke to him.
Yes.
And he got out of bed and gave his heart to the Lord. What I do remember vividly is that for 5 years, he could not talk to you for 5 minutes without talking about his friend Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
It revolutionized his life, turned it upside down, gave him something to live for.
It did. We were on a book tour. We were in Westwood, I remember, in Los Angeles, and a very funny moment. Now, this guy never missed an opportunity to share Jesus with anybody. Yes. Even when we had the auditions for the movie, there were all these kids in there. He had them all stay after they auditioned, and he shared Christ with all of them. I'm saying, okay, this is not like an audition we do in Hollywood. You know, yeah. He's up there. He's got the microphone, and I'm going, oh, dear, how are they going to handle this? And the people were just on the edge of their seats. It was pretty amazing. But it got him in trouble one time. We were at this bookstore, and this young man walks up. He says, Pete, can I talk to you privately? And Pete says, well, of course. So he takes the kid, and you got the bookshelves, you know, it's in a bookstore.
Yeah.
He's back there, and we couldn't hear what they were saying. And he got to share Christ with them, you know, shared his testimony. The conversation ends, the kid leaves. And we said, Pete, what was that about? He said, well, it went really well. I could tell he was really listening to every word I said, but then he kind of ended the conversation kind of abruptly. I said, well, what did he say? He goes, Pete, can I ask you something really personal? Sure. The kid then looked him in the eye and said, did you have garlic for lunch?
Oh, you're kidding me. Did he?
So Pete was completely, have you ever seen this superstar who's always sure on his feet? He was blown away. We laughed for about 5 minutes. So yeah, that was one of his funnier witnessing moments. But the guy always saw everybody as an opportunity. He tells a story about when he was on a plane and they were going through horrible turbulence. And he said, I just began to pray for everybody on board. And I remember when they landed, they were complaining about how they had landed late.
Oh.
You know, he says, wow, you know, we got to keep things in perspective.
Well, let's pick up with the relationship with his father, because it was his goal to win his father for Christ, particularly since Presmerovich was dying.
Yes, sir.
And he was passionate about getting his father to understand that he could live forever and that he could be with his dad again. Tell us more that you know about how that occurred.
The story I'd like to tell would be the change of Press. Press was, I mean, he was a tough guy. And he had come up in Aliquippa, the steel mills, you know, working late at night, early in the morning, going to school a little bit, and then playing basketball, then going back to work. I don't know when he slept, to be honest, but he was a tough guy. Then he entered the military, and during World War II, he was a pilot of a B-17. And he saw a lot of horrible things. One of his friends that he played basketball with took off down the strip, and his plane just blew up right in front of him, right after they had a conversation about what a great day they had had. So he had seen the horrors of war, and he was a tough guy, and he, you know, Press didn't have a father.
Yeah.
His father died tragically and was run over by a train near the steel mills. And so he didn't have a dad. So there's this thing that you and I love to talk about is fathers and sons, right? And the impact that dad can have on his son. Well, I think Press was just dedicated and devoted to, this is not going to happen to my boy. I'm going to be there for him. But he was so intense and often angry, you know. Well, once he saw Pete's transformation, there was a transformation in Press that was amazing. He did come to a day where he says, Pete, I want the peace that you have. I want that.
Was that on his deathbed?
No, it was before then. Thank the Lord, is before then, because they got to do some camps together, some basketball camps. He had a Pistol Pete, you know, basketball camp. And I remember his pastor, Rodney Wood, I think, told me this story where one of the kids had misbehaved, or a couple of them had, and Press was ready to say, you know, you're going to send him home, you know, from the camp. You're booted out. But the pastor came to him and says, you know, Press, what you should do in this situation is show some grace to these children, because you may be the only Jesus that they get to meet, in a sense. Mm-hmm. So he goes back to these kids, and rather than anger, he goes back, puts his arms around him, saying, okay, guys, look, I know you messed up. You said you're sorry. I'm going to let you stay. And that was a real touch point or a threshold moment for him in his Christianity, was grace and mercy. Mm-hmm. Before he didn't have it, it was like, get off the court, you know.
Yeah. Daryl, you got to see Pete and his father Press up close and personal. You were there in the house when some dramatic things took place. Did you observe what we now know, that Pete and his father were not always compatible with each other? They were antagonists at one time.
Yes, as Press loved his boy. He loved him like no father, like every father should love their son, obviously. But it was contentious at times because Press was his coach, and he wanted to be the man, the person. And if you think cradle to superstar, he wanted to be that guy that helped unleash Pete up on the NCAA.
Did he drive him too hard?
He drove him very hard, but you know what? Pete, in a way, loved it. It was like the fuel in the machine. Well, one of the major speed bumps they hit was when Press said, Pete, I'm going to take the job at LSU. Well, LSU was a big football school. It wasn't a basketball school. They had an arena they played in. They had to bring the floor in. It was covered in dirt. They called it the Cow Palace, remember? Yeah. And so he said, Dad, there's no way. There's no way. How can you be, basically, how dare you take a job down there in Louisiana when you could have stayed here in the ACC? He had been a coach at Clemson. It had great success. Yeah. And he said, basically, it got heated, and the boiling point was, Pete, you come to play with me at LSU, or I will never speak to you again.
You're kidding.
It was awful. It was awful. And, of course, Pete loved this man, and he acquiesced, and he went, and the rest is history.
There was a fantastic reconciliation toward the end of Press's life.
Can I share that with you?
Yes.
Let me tell you what happened. Press got really sick. He had bone cancer. And Pete said, not on my watch. You are not going to die this way. I'm going to do whatever I can do. Dad, we're going to get you healed. And it just got worse and worse and worse. Now, this was a real testing of Pete's faith, you know. I mean, he was still growing in his faith. And Press and he battled together. And Pete, not only did he take him to Germany for some experimental drugs, he literally carried his father. Get this picture, Doc. He's carrying his dad through the airport and in his arms. And on the plane, there weren't seats together. I don't know what the problem was with people back then, but he stood in the back of the airplane with his dad in sitting, and Pete stood from Germany back to America.
Yeah,
it was just amazing. But
couldn't do that today.
No, sir. He gave his all for his father to live there at the end. And he stayed there holding his hand, and he said, when his father breathed his last breath, he said, Dad, I will see you soon. And he didn't know it was going to be like 6 months later, right? He said, I'll see you soon. And he said he stayed there. The room went silent. He says, I just know my father kind of hovered there for a bit, and we talked. And that was the death of Press Maravich.
And he passed.
Mm.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Does the full arc from that heated to I'll do anything for you, you know?
Well, we've been talking to Daryl Campbell. He's the author of the book Hero and Friend, referring to Pete Maravich. In fact, the subtitle is My Days with Pistol Pete Maravich. And there are wonderful stories in here. Our time is gone, but I want to pick up next time, if you'll stay with us. And I want to begin with your recollections and memories of the day that Pete died,
Okay. How
you heard about it, and what impact it had on you. Let's do that next time, shall we?
Love to.
Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, sir.
I'm Roger Marsh, and you've been listening to Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. Dr. Dobson's guest today on the broadcast has been screenwriter and director Daryl Campbell. Visit the broadcast page for more information at drjamesdobson.org. While you're there, you can learn more about Daryl's many writings about the basketball icon, Pete Maravich. That's drjamesdobson.org, and then click onto the broadcast page. Well, tune in again tomorrow for the conclusion of Dr. Dobson's interview with screenwriter and director Daryl Campbell. Now, they'll be sharing their own accounts of the day Pete Maravich died. And they'll also talk about his love for sharing the gospel. Don't miss that conversation coming up next time right here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Roger Marsh. Have a blessed day.
This has been a presentation of the Dr. James Dobson Family Institute.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Tim Clinton, Executive Director of the James Dobson Family Institute. Our ministry here exists to honor the Lord through ministering to today's families and marriages all over the world. We couldn't accomplish that, however, without your support. And as the JDFI, the James Dobson Family Institute, continues to grow, we need your help. Visit us, will you do that, at drjamesdobson.org or call us toll-free at 877-732-6825. Stand with us and fight for righteousness and culture.